Doug Shapiro, thank you so much for joining me today. Super excited to chat with you. And I was going through your LinkedIn. You are currently an advisor to Boston Consulting Group, BCG. And before that, you've worked at Bank of America. You've worked at Time Warner, Turner Broadcasting, a SPAC as well. So you have a really, really diverse background. So first of all, I'd love to hear more about that. And also, I'd love to also hear about how it looked like your initial entryway into kind of, you know, the workforce was really focused around finance. And then you transitioned to more of a media focus. So I'd love to see, you know, hear about that.
Yeah, sure. And thank you for having me on. As I mentioned before we actually started rolling, I follow you on Twitter. I feel like I already know you, even though this is our first official meeting. And yeah, it should be fun. So I've been in and around the media business for about 30 years, about half outside and half inside. So I spent, you know, 14, 15 years as a sell-side equity analyst at Deutsche Bank, at Bank of America. And, you know, that's the same job when you see stuff written by Rich Greenfield or Michael Nathanson or Ben Swinburne or Doug Mitchelson or, you know, any of the analysts. That's what I did. And I covered cable and satellite and entertainment. So I've been, I was an observer of the businesses from the outside. And then I went over to Time Warner, where I was for 12 years. And for the first 6 years, I was running investor relations. So that's a job where we're really the conduit between the company and Wall Street. So it's really kind of, it's a variant of the same job, which is kind of going to the other side of the table. And then I did some other strategy roles. And my last 4 years, I ran corporate strategy, data strategy, and research for Turner. And then after I left, I've been doing some advisory stuff. I burned about 18 months on a failed SPAC, which was a very interesting experience where I learned that A, the markets are eventually rational, and B, if you get involved in a mania, you should probably get involved early. And, I love the media business. I love the dynamism of it. I love how, you know, the application of the practical application of economic frameworks to what's going on. I just find a lot of fun. So I've been, writing stuff also and posting it, which I'm sure is the genesis of our conversation today.
Awesome. Okay. So tell me about the early days of the media business. And, you know, because you said you've been in media for 30 years. And so when you first started, what was the landscape like? And then after you moved from the more financial oriented positions into moving from the bank jobs, essentially, to more of a on the media side, tell me about that transition. So I guess, like, what the landscape looked like early on, how has it evolved? And then also that transition from, different types of job industries.
Yeah, well, how it's evolved. When I first started, cable was emergent, you know, the broadcast now. I mean, and most of my career has really been around television, right? So I a lot of things I'm going to say are going to be more TV focused, not necessarily applicable to all of media, but I'll try to work that in. So, when I started, the broadcast was still dominant. I think it still had, you know, probably something like a 60-70% share of viewing on any given night. Cable was still emerging. You had, like, you know, the big established networks, the CNNs, the ESPNs, you know, they were out there. I do remember when ESPN launched and I think the first thing they showed was like a polka festival or something. It was, you know, it was not Monday Night Football, let's put it that way. And I remember when Cartoon Network launched, all these networks were launching, and there was, you know, the perception of unlimited, but a lot of demand for consumers for these network verticals. And then obviously at some point in that time frame, let's say, you know, toward the kind of turn of the century, you had the real birth of internet media, native internet media. And at least from the TV side, the most interesting thing was the emergence of Netflix, which really happened around kind of like the, you know, at least its streaming service became important sometime in the kind of like 2008, 2009, 2010 era. And really what you've seen play out since then in television is just a textbook example of Clayton Christensen's low-end disruption, right? You have somebody come in with a crappy product. Well, you usually start with an overserved industry, right? And what had happened in the cable business was that the cable networks were over-earning, right? Their margins were off the charts. If you look relative to the rest of the economy, like incredibly profitable businesses, too many networks, too high a price. You used to always see these charts of comparing, you know, cable TV pricing against CPI, and it was a huge divergence. So an industry that was over-serving customers, someone comes in with a crappy product, the incumbents kind of laugh it off. You remember at the beginning of Netflix streaming, it was just some old series and movies that, you know, nobody really wanted to watch. It was free. It was given away free as part of the DVD by mail service, right? And then, just played the whole playbook, just kept getting better and better, picking off more and more of the incumbents' customer base. The incumbents not only ignored it, but actually empowered it by licensing all their content, right? Making it stronger and stronger. Then Netflix gets into originals, and somewhere in some of the things I've written, I probably have a chart that shows what that looks like, but just kind of kept on moving up the performance curve until you got to the point where, you know, and now Netflix is better than a lot of traditional cable and broadcast networks, and, you know, certainly in terms of the breadth of its content and the quality of its content. And then the incumbents, you know, seeing all this happen, finally threw in the towel a few years ago and said, hey, we're going to try to replicate this business model. They all jumped into streaming with both feet. And just, you know, in the last year or so, they've figured out that the business is neither as large nor as profitable as they hoped. And so there's a lot of angst in the entertainment business right now, which is all a consequence of that lengthy process. So I don't know if that gives you like a general overview. I think, you know, what you could say is that parallels pretty closely to what you've seen in other media businesses, right? In the sense that, you know, with the internet, digitization really was the great equalizer because it reduced the atomic unit of every media to the bit, right? It used to be like, what was the atomic unit of an article? Maybe a paragraph or a word or a letter or a song. It's a stanza or a note, or, you know, for a movie, maybe it's a frame. All of a sudden it's bits. It's all bits. It's the only, that's the atomic unit of all media. And then the internet comes in and sets the path to transport those bits around to zero, right? Like, so it really dramatically reduces the cost to transport the bits around. And that, you know, reduction or plummeting of the barriers entry to distribute content is really, you know, you've seen that ripple through all these different media.
Okay. So you're talking about the plumbing and how the costs were greatly reduced to distribute that media. And that kind of opened up Netflix and now all these other streaming services. So could you take me back into the era of, like, you know, the cable times and I guess pre-internet as to why, you know, how was content distributed there? And then also, why were the margins so fat? And why didn't other people just say, hey, you know, the margins are huge here. Your margin's my opportunity. I'm going to now do a startup that's going to, you know, bring those margins down. Was it like a issue with actual, like, you know, lines in the ground that, like, you had to own, or, you know, tell me about that, the early days.
Yeah. I mean, you know, basically I think as a generality, what the internet did was it unbundled information from infrastructure. And so prior to the advent of the internet, if you wanted to distribute television content, you really needed to own the underlying infrastructure. So, you know, for the cable companies, that was initially coaxial cable, and then they installed hybrid fiber coax. You know, they converted these hybrid fiber coax networks, which meant laying a lot of fiber. DirecTV and Dish or EchoStar, you know, they had to launch satellites, so they'd have to invest in uplink facilities, throw satellites in the air. So incredibly capital intensive stuff. And in the cable business in particular, it's so capital intensive that it effectively became a natural monopoly. So cable systems are not government granted monopolies. It's just that once you start laying, once you start digging trenches, or stringing cable on poles, it's going to dissuade anyone else from coming and making the same investment in those same places. So when the, I forget what they call it, the initial, there's a, there's some interesting books about the birth of the cable industry and how, these, you know, early cable pioneers would just go from like town to town to try to obtain the local franchise and try to get, you know, try to get money in the ground as fast as possible to scare everybody else off. And you end up with this like incredibly balkanized system where, you know, their cable, you know, cable companies would have a network here, a network there. And it took like, you know, 20, 30 years, 40 years for the industry to rationalize geographically. But anyway, you ended up with these natural monopolies, more or less. Satellite kind of broke that, you know, but satellite really is, even there, you ended up with a relatively comfortable duopoly, oligopoly structure. So there wasn't really a huge incentive for, you know, for dramatic price cutting on the part of the distributors. And then from the cable network providers. So, you know, just kind of backing up, the way the business works is that what are sometimes the nomenclature gets a little confusing, but you'd have cable networks and cable systems, right? And the cable networks are the ones who are creating and packaging and branding the content, right? So that's CNN and MTV and ESPN and, you know, the corporate parents of, at the time, Time Warner, and at the time, Viacom and Disney. They would, you know, again, package the content, brand the content, and then license those networks to cable systems, Comcast, Charter, you know, now, you know, all these things have gone through different corporate structural changes, Altice, you know, and then you had the advent of satellite. Like I said, it was DirecTV, and then it was Dish. And then it, at some point, the telco started to also get into video distribution as well, but were always, you know, somewhat hamstrung by the nature of their infrastructure, that they didn't have as much fiber in the ground as the cable companies did. They were sort of saddled with twisted pair, lower bandwidth copper cabling. So anyway, you ended up with these kind of, you know, a bunch of cable networks, most of which were consolidated within a handful of corporate, big corporate entities, you know, big entertainment companies. And then you had in any given market, probably one cable company, two satellite companies, and sometimes you'd have a telco to choose from. So you ended up with, you know, a relatively stable market structure, competitive dynamic. And so what would happen is the key to the whole business model is that all these networks were bundled, right? Consumers really didn't have a lot of choices when they went to, you know, went to go get pay TV. There'd be like, you know, the purple package and the silver and the gold or whatever. Maybe there'd be three or four packages, but there wasn't there wasn't a lot of choice. What would happen is the cable networks would every year they would frequently create new networks. You know, ESPN2. If you ever watched Dodgeball, there's that joke about the Ocho. You know, ESPN8, right? You know, I mean, you just think about any of these. At one point, there was a CNN Financial Network. There was a anyway. You could kind of go back in time just to finish the point. You basically had a very cozy and stable value chain, right? A bunch of cable networks, mostly consolidated within a handful of big media companies. In most markets, you only had a handful of choices for the consumer. And all of those distributors, cable, telco, satellite, were bundling up all these networks and selling them in a relatively small number of packages, right? So as a consumer, you had very little choice. And so what typically happened was the cable networks would enter into contracts with the distributors that included annual price escalators. Could be 5, could be 7. In the case of ESPN, which is really the forerunner of really pushing price, you were seeing double digit increases in pricing every single year. And then the distributors would just pass those price increases along to the customer base. And so, so you had customers who considered cable a necessity. You know, TV is a necessity. A lot of people consider it to be a utility. It's, you know, it's as important as, at least at that time, there used to be stories about people who would like have their electricity cut and then run a generator in their backyard, but still keep paying for cable because it was more important to have TV than to have electricity, right? So people considered it a necessity. They were all, you know, price takers as consumers, and the rest of the value chain was just kind of pushing price. And so that's how you ended up with people paying a lot for these packages and generally not watching a very large percentage of them. So in one of the things I've written, I show a chart that shows some Nielsen data, which illustrates, I think the average household was watching, I can't remember the number, it's like 13 or 14 or 15 networks a month, even as they, you know, the number of networks they'd have went from 100 to 120 to 150. So people were watching, you know, 10%, less than 10% of the networks that they got. They weren't even, you know, they're only watching 10% of what they paid for. And that's how you ended up with an industry where, you know, very stable value chain, high margin, high pricing power. And that's, you know, that's how you ended up with an industry that's just so ripe to be disrupted.
So when Netflix came on the scene, you said it was like, what, 06, 07, something like that, right?
Well, I'm trying to remember when Netflix, you know, I think Netflix as a DVD by mail service might have been like 1998 or something, right?
Oh, it's
like,
wow. Okay.
I don't even know. But I think, you know, when Netflix came out and was first, I think the first Netflix streaming product, I'm going to guess like 06, 07, somewhere in there.
When that happened, were you on top of that saying, oh my gosh, this is crazy? Or was it more so, oh, this is interesting, you know, kind of cute?
Yeah. I mean, at the time, no, I was not on top of that because I think it just didn't seem that relevant.
Totally.
Think the big catalyst for Netflix was, I think it was in 2009, Netflix licensed the entirety of the Starz library. So at the time, Starz had the Sony and Disney Pay One movie rights. So, you know, Pay One is the first window availability on pay TV after home video, right? So typically with movies, you know, the movie's in the theaters, then it's available on DVD. And then the first window where we go to television is called Pay One, right? The first pay window. And at that time, Starz had, like I said, Sony movies, Disney movies. It had, I think, some originals and then a big library of older movies. And it licensed the entirety of that. So they're selling that service as an a la carte service through Comcast and DirecTV and making at the time, you know, probably $300 million a year from the distributors. And they license all that stuff for like $30 million or $25 million to Netflix. So all of a sudden Netflix had the entire Starz library that they got for 1/10 of what Starz was making from everybody else. But it was actually a better product on Netflix because it was all on demand, right? You know, it was kind of, that was really the thing that was, I think, woke everybody up, or at least woke me up. I mean, I remember at the time I was running investor relations and it really worried. That was the first time investors were like, holy crap, what's going on here? You know, I think for the people running the media companies, in some cases, it took them years to wake up to what was happening.
Really? Interesting. So the investors, you know, knew before the actual operators. Is that kind of accurate?
I think, yeah, a lot of operators were quite dismissive of it. And when I was at Time Warner and we used to, you know, talk all the time about what kind of threat it was and how we wanted to do business with Netflix. And we were very wary of licensing Netflix content. And, you know, Netflix at the time was pushing not only to license content, but to shorten the windows, right? So, you know, typically in the way windowing worked on television was that you wouldn't really sell a show into syndication until it had been on for about 4 or 5 years. The theory was you need, you know, that at that time you were doing kind of 22 episodes a year. And the theory was you needed 100 episodes in the can before you could syndicate it. Because, you know, remember, you're taking a show, it's on broadcast, it's on once a week during the season, right? So it's on 22 times a year, original episodes. But when that gets syndicated to your local broadcast station or to TBS or the cable network, they're going to run that thing like every day, right? So you need to have a lot of episodes. Like, so, you know, a Friends or whatever is not going to go into syndication until it's got 100 plus episodes in the can, right? which means definitionally it doesn't end up in syndication until it's at least 4 years. It's been 4 years since the debut. So Netflix is not bound by the same, you know, they're not trying to fill airtime. So they were pushing for a much shorter syndication window. And we were incredibly resistant to that. And a lot of other media companies, they've said, you know, we're going to take the money, you know, and they started to license a lot of content to Netflix. And it became a little bit like crack, you know, like they're got addicted. All of a sudden, you know, they're reporting these big increases on their content licensing lines, which Wall Street loves. And then all of a sudden that starts to get baked into the budget. You know, each year they're budgeting some licensing dollars from Netflix, which means now executives' compensation is actually contingent on licensing.
Oh, wow.
And so they're like, yeah, it's free money. Yeah. You know, and at that time, you know, cable subs were still, or pay TV subs were still growing. It's like, hey, it's free money. And I mean, we were always like, it ain't free money. You're going to, you know, this is all going to come home to roost at some point. But like I said, it took a lot of our peers a long time to before they got religion on that.
Wow. Okay. So it went from cable networks were very fragmented. Then it turned into kind of an oligopoly situation. Then we had Netflix and they were kind of the big disruptor where, and they, you know, they turned it into a quasi monopoly for a period of time. Now everyone has a streaming service, it feels like, and there's like 50 of these things. So what's happening now? Because, you know, a lot of people have caught up to Netflix, have really good content as well. So what's happening now and what does the future hold?
Yeah. So what's happening now is that over the last few years, really starting, I think, in end of 18 or in 19, you've had all of the big entertainment companies have launched their own streaming services. So you have Disney's Plus. You had, you know, HBO Max, Discovery Plus. I mean, now they're one company and they're folding those into one service. CBS has something called CBS All Access, which has now been folded into Paramount Plus. And so, and NBC Universal has Peacock, right? So the really big ones from the, you know, the traditional media companies now are Disney Plus, what I think Warner Brothers Discovery is calling Max. I think they're renaming their combined service Max, Peacock, and Paramount Plus. And then, of course, at the same time, you know, you have Apple TV with its product, right? You have Amazon Prime, which has been very aggressive. And, of course, you have Netflix. So, you know, you have, depending on how you want to do the math, six or seven big, relatively aggressive, vertically integrated general entertainment streaming services. What happened was that, you know, upon launch, all these things were growing really fast and the street loved it. And the street was encouraging these companies to continue to kind of put the pedal to the metal and continue to invest in content. And in a way, everyone was sort of chasing Netflix's valuation, right? The big shock came at the fourth quarter of 21 when Netflix reported for its fourth quarter 21 numbers. I think that's when it was, and reported disappointing subscriber numbers. And those got even worse in the first quarter of 22. And so over the last year, there's been this big shift as people are starting to realize that the business is not going to be as big as many hoped. And so not only are you starting to see you're seeing sub growth slow really industry wide, but you're also seeing that churn rates are really high. And, you know, what's happened is the switching costs, of being a cable sub were pretty high, right? Because if you wanted to swap out, cancel your cable, you had to like call up. And then the technician, they'd give you like a window from like 8 a.m. to midnight or something. And you'd have to stay home and wait. The guy would come and get dirt on your carpet. And that's how you cancel the service, right? Or maybe you disconnected the boxes and drove them over to the local Verizon store, something like that. Now it's the click of a button, right? So the on streaming, the switching costs are much, much lower. And you start to see that... for some consumers, stream churn is just becoming a habitual activity. They're using churn as a way of managing cost, right? So, you know, Netflix, for instance, when they drop the entirety of Stranger Things season 3, and then 18 million people watch the whole season in a weekend, you know, they're like, wow, that's awesome. That shows really high fan affinity. It's like, okay, yeah, but it also might show that people are they're going to chew up the whole thing and then they're going to churn, right? And I've written some stuff about churn as well. And, you know, one interesting stat that I showed is there's a company called Antenna, which has really great churn data. And based on some data they gave me, I was able to show that, or their data shows that in any given month, you know, 40% of Netflix's gross ads are people who had canceled within the last 12 months. So, you know, 40% are people who had churned off and are churning back on. They had churned off within the last year, they're churning back on. And for a lot of the other big streamers, it's, you know, 30, 35%. So it just shows you a very large proportion of the people you're spending money to bring on in any given month, they churned off in the past because, you know, they're not going to be stable customers. They just churn off and churn back on habitually based on what's on and based on what their budget is.
So in this world where, you know, 10 different options for, not 10, but, you know, we'll call it 5 different options for streaming, you know, is it going to be, will they consolidate into 3? And those will be like the oligopoly. Like, are we just kind of replaying the cable? What happened with cable through, you know, streaming services?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately, you know, right now it's pretty clear the market can't support 6 or 7 or 8, whatever it is, vertically integrated streaming services. Like, there's no scenario where the average person's going to take, you know, whatever, 6 or 7 subscriptions. And just last week, Bob Iger was at the Morgan Stanley conference and he made that same point. He's like, you know, with 6 or 7 well-funded streamers, everybody can't win, right? So it doesn't work from the supply side, and from the demand side, it's just not a good consumer experience, right? Because you're still like, your experience used to be unified in one app, right? Your app was a set-top box, right? It was the horrible electronic program guide on DirecTV or on the old Comcast set-top boxes. But at least it was one experience where you knew all your videos there. And now all of a sudden, like, you know, as a consumer, I'm sure you've had this experience. You're like, you hear about a show, you're like, what service? You don't know which service it's on. So, you know, Roku and Apple TV have tried to create universal, you know, search across apps. But even then, you know, you're still like deep linking into an app. You're still like, you know, jumping from app to app. So it's not a great consumer experience. And it's also, you know, unsustainable from the supply side. So it's pretty reasonable to expect that over some time frame, you have to see some sort of rationalization, right? And it could be consolidation. An alternative is, and I wrote a piece about this recently called, you know, what will the streaming peace look like? Meaning the streaming wars are over, now we're moving into streaming peace. And one version is you see consolidation. Another version is that the industry shifts to a more horizontal organization, meaning that the streamers who are subscale in distribution sort of shift resources more toward wholesaling, you know, so that like you could see a world where Paramount, Peacock, even, you know, Warner Brothers Discovery, even Disney Plus say, you know, we're going to license our entire service to YouTube. YouTube is going to try to become the home of all TV. Each of those services is going to be a tile inside their app. It'll be one unified experience. They will, you know, use all their data to monetize our ad inventory, you know, whatever it is. Like, you could imagine that's a much better consumer experience. It's, and especially, you know, just to pause there for a second, what I'm describing is what happened in music. And I don't think a lot of people necessarily remember this, but Universal Music Group, Warner, Sony, all these guys tried to become vertically integrated. There was a MusicNet and Press Play. They each had their own streaming service. And then at some point, they're like, yeah, this isn't going to work. And, you know, and of course, what the music labels did a really good job of is playing one DSP off another. So it's basically Spotify versus Apple Music versus YouTube, right? Versus Amazon. So because of that competitive dynamic, the labels are able to extract most of the economic rent, even though they don't own their own distribution. So I think in the near term, what the first, before we talk about market structure, the first thing that's happening is all of these companies are moving to, you know, rationalize economically. Like, you're generally, basically, you know, what happened was Netflix dug a hole and everybody else jumped into the hole. And they're like, oh, crap, we're in a hole. Like, oh, yeah, you're in a hole. Who knew, right? So now everyone's trying to claw themselves out of the hole. And the way they're doing that is, you know, there's been a lot of price increases. You've seen Netflix. Everyone's now introducing advertising-supported tiers. Netflix is now cracking down on password sharing. You've seen indications of a lot of these companies cutting back on content spend and on marketing spends. So you're seeing this sort of collective economic rationalization happening in the business. That's step one. I think step two would be some sort of rationalization of the market structure.
Okay, so we've been talking a lot about the distribution rails, like the plumbing and then the content. You know, how does that look today? Just because I feel like it's evolved a lot from the times of cable. And then where are we going? Because especially with, you know, YouTube is completely free to distribute content. And also for content generation, you know, we very recently have these incredible AI tools that you're able to generate content at like 100x cheaper. That's pretty high quality. So I guess, like, tell me about the landscape of distribution and content creation today. And where are we headed?
Well, you know, you're touching on this piece that I recently wrote called Forget Peak TV, Here Comes Infinite TV. And the point of that piece was that when you think about all of the hand-wringing that currently is occurring in the entertainment business along the whole value chain, it's really been driven entirely by the disruption only of distribution, right? And as we've been talking about, barriers to entry have plummeted into distributed content, but at least in video, the barriers to entry to create content have only gone up because, you know, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, a cable original probably ran, you know, $3-4 million an hour. Now you see $8-15 million an hour is pretty common. And because of that, there's still a very deep moat around content creation. And if you were to look at, you know, who makes all the content, it's still a handful of companies. It's still Disney and Comcast and Warner Brothers Discovery and Paramount and Apple, Netflix and Amazon. Like, that is basically right there, probably 95% or something of total content spend in the United States is just that handful of companies, because it's so expensive and so risky that you need to have a very large balance sheet. And you also have to have a portfolio of projects to absorb the risk, right? So, you know, main premise of this piece I wrote was that those barriers to creation are also set to fall. And the reason is because of a couple of technologies. One of them is short form, where I think, you know, short form is, it's changing the consumer definition of quality. For certain consumers, it's lowering the bar of what they consider quality, right? Like, where they're not as concerned about high production value. So that, you know, so the bar is kind of coming down. And then you look at numbers 2 and 3, which is virtual production and AI, which are kind of hand in glove. And virtual production, by virtual production, I'm referring to creating linear video content within gaming engines like, you know, Unreal Engine and Unity and NVIDIA Omniverse. And then when I talk about AI, I'm really talking about AI-enabled creation tools. So those two things together are democratizing high production value tools. And then the fourth thing is Web3, where it has the potential, at least, to break Hollywood's stranglehold on financing, right? That's one of the major, you know. So I think when you synthesize all that, or to put it maybe a different way, in video, there's already, that's in video, not NVIDIA. In the video business, there's already infinite user-generated content, right? The last time YouTube gave this number was in 2019, but they said that 500 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube every hour. I'm sorry, every minute. That's 30,000 hours an hour, which is equivalent to Netflix's entire library. So one Netflix is uploaded to YouTube every hour. Today, most of that stuff is very low quality, right? People don't think of it as the same quality as professionally produced content. They don't think of it as the same use case. But when you play out these, when you look at these tools that are evolving or these technological trends, you can see that over the next five, seven, whatever, 10 years, that the quality distinction between professionally produced content and creator content is going to start to blur. And just given the sheer volume, this creator content, if even a tiny percentage of it is considered by consumers to be high quality, it could completely upend the entire ecosystem.
Okay, so alluding to that, like, what does that mean? Like, I feel like you know, I feel like there's some major shifts happening today, and you know, it's like a trickle right now. Like, we're seeing it on Twitter and clips here and clips there. Like, wow, this technology can now create a really high end anime video, and you know, for 100x cheaper.
Yeah.
So we're seeing little bits and pieces. We haven't seen it like the full deluge that I think is coming. But so I'd love to hear from you. Like, what does that mean, and what's going to happen?
You know, I think the first thing you probably see is smaller teams that are able to make really high quality content with, you know, I mean, a smaller team, smaller budget, and a shorter time frame, right? So I think that's probably the first step. Like, you know, the question is, like, when is the first really high quality episodic, either, you know, feature length movie or episodic TV show going to be released on YouTube, right? Where it's purely ad supported. Because one of the implications of what we're talking about, where you're talking, you know, orders of magnitude, potential for orders of magnitude reduction in the cost structure, is that the whole monetization model could be completely different too, right? Like, right now, content is externally, video, high quality video content is externally expensive. That's why it's all contained within these pretty expensive monthly subscription packages, because that's the only way that you could possibly make the economics work. If it costs, you know, like I said, if it's an order or two orders of magnitude less to create high quality stuff, then, you know, maybe it's just on YouTube ad supported. Maybe, you know, you, instead of free to play video gaming, you have free to play video, where, you know, free to watch video, where it's actually top of funnel. You're going to get a million or 10 million people to watch a TV show and somehow monetize the, you know, the very bottom, you know, the top 1% are going to, you're going to sell them NFTs or merch, or who, you know, it's completely, it's hard to imagine, like, all the knock-on effects here. It's like, it's very difficult to get your head around, like, how things might change. I think for the big media, for the big entertainment companies, if they can lean into these tools, right, if they were to really embrace these new technologies, there's an opportunity for them to lower their cost structure. But the, you know, the flip side is that the barriers to entry to be creating quality stuff are going to keep falling.
So, and this is kind of a tangent a little bit, but there's these guys on YouTube. They're called Corridor Digital. Corridor Crew.
Yeah.
And have you seen that? Have you seen the video I'm alluding to where they made the whole anime and it was like four guys, but it was two guys acting?
The rock, paper, scissors one?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So to explain this, it's basically four guys, two guys that are, you know, in front of a green screen acting, and then two other guys helping on production. But they made this 7-minute 20-second anime video that was really cool, you know, very, very cheaply with four people and like a pretty small number of production assets, right? Compared to like a huge studio. Like, that is game changing. Like, I can't see how we're not going to be absolutely flooded with just, you know, billions of hours of content over the next year or two. And like, I don't see it slowing down. And if anything, it could get automated at some point, where people are automating YouTube shows or, you know, TikTok shows or whatever.
So, I think that it's definitely worthwhile to mess around on the Carter Digital site. There's, or really on their YouTube channel, because they have some awesome stuff that they've done. They did a really cool thing where they took live action MCU content and then basically created a movie using that, but converted it into the, stylistically, it looked like, the Spider-Man Enter the Spider-Verse, the animated, you know, so they basically took this live action stuff and made it animated and pulled it in and created their own movie. It was really cool. I'd also encourage you to go just look at the at the Runway ML website. They have a new service, which I think is still in beta, called Gen 1, which is really amazing because basically you can take footage. It will apply the style of a photograph to your video. So you could have a person in a park, and this is one of the things they show. They show a guy like kind of trudging through snow, and then they apply the style of the moon to this video, and now the guy is an astronaut walking on the moon, right? And so when you see stuff like that, you just realize, point, like the tools that are going to be in the hands of creators are improving so fast. And you know, Hollywood is still, you know, most likely going to be stuck making content the way it always has for a long time. I mean, the history is, if you're a student of the history of these things, you would not be optimistic about their ability to pivot quickly. It's a really interesting question. This is inevitable. It's just a matter of the when.
So, you know, I love going on Twitter and, you know, causing alarm and making people freak out. I keep writing like Hollywood is being disrupted. It's Hollywood's internet moment. And I can't help but actually, you know, I do believe that. Like before, I feel like the barriers were really about content creation, where, you know, I can't with my buddies, you know, make anything remotely close to a Netflix series. Yep. But now, I think in the near future, maybe not today, you can compete with a Netflix series, but in a year, 2 years from now, I think, you know, we'll be able to. And I mean, like me and you, we could like, you know, get some tools up and going. Yeah. I have no experience.
Yeah. If you look at like Avatar, I found this data when I'm doing research recently that just shows the number of people involved in some of these big movies and TV shows, and it's thousands. Like I don't know the number for Avatar: Way of Water, but I would bet at anything it's more than 5,000 people were involved in making that, right? So in 10 years, is someone banging out the equivalent of an Avatar in their dorm room, right? I mean, you know, that sounds insane, but that does feel like it's the path we're on. Yeah, I mean, you raised something before that I didn't answer, which I think is just an interesting question, is like how much of this is really automated and where do you have human intervention, you know, which I think is an important question. Because, you know, in one of the pieces I wrote, I think I described this as the generative AI doom loop, where you could imagine a completely automated content creator using, you know, Imogen or, you know, one of these, like, you know, one of these text, you know, you basically feed a couple prompts into ChatGPT. It's automatically linked into a text to video generator. That stuff then is seeded out onto TikTok or YouTube, and then whatever the network, you know, collectively people decide is good, gets more resources pumped into it. And so you basically, you use TikTok and YouTube basically as your focus groups. And then, so just like endless, infinite amounts of content are being generated constantly, right? That feels like a not very pleasant world to live in for some reason, I don't know. But, you know, I was reading this Ben Thompson, Stratechery, however you pronounce it, piece, where he had an interesting framework for thinking about the content value chain. And the way he phrased it was, there's creation, substantiation, duplication, distribution, and consumption. And to me, creation is not like the best word, it probably should be ideation. So, you know, his point is that what AI is doing is unbundling what we'll call ideation from substantiation, right? From the idea, from the making of it. And I think that's more the way I think about it, is that that it's really, you're still going to need people to have the ideas. And just to, since I'm on a riff here and I've taken over this whole thing with my digression, I was watching this, I was recently watching this presentation from these guys who've been commissioned by a producer to create a script written by AI. And they did a demo for about an hour, and it was really impressive what they came up with from scratch in an hour, but it was all about their prompting and refining and prompting and refining. So it was like prompt after prompt, like they're getting something back from the AI, then they would, you know, put in a new prompt, they would refine. So it was like, it was kind of like a writer's table where the head writer is a human and all the other writers are robots, right? So you still needed a creative director to understand how to mold and push and refine. And I think that's what we'll end up with is that. But, you know, that dovetails into what we were talking about earlier, is that you end up with, you know, a really creative person sitting alone in their room. You know, I mean, Billie Eilish and Phineas are cutting an album in their house, right? How far are we from like Andrew and your wife are cutting a movie in your house? And I think, so I think that is what we're headed to over some time frame. And yeah, it'll be enormously disruptive. And it's like, you need to put a cold compress on your head to even start to think about what it all means.
Okay. So speaking of that, if, you know, we can create IP very easily and, you know, content, and if the distribution rails are essentially free, we'll call it YouTube, who is the advantage? Like, how do you win in that environment where both the rails are open, the content generation is basically free and open? Like, how do you outcompete?
It's a really good question. I think what we've seen so far, and I just wrote something about this that I published today, it's very clear that the internet it causes power law like popularity distributions, right? So you see power law distributions across everything, you know, every media. I mean, you can think about it right now, like, you know, you look at like Top Gun Maverick, or you think Stranger Things, or you think like there's things at the very tippy top of the curve that will extract disproportionate economics. And then you have everything else in the tail that really doesn't make a lot of money. And the only people who really make money in the tail are the people who either A, aggregate the tail, you know, so that's like YouTube is the one who make, you know, who makes money on YouTube is YouTube. It's not, I mean, Mr. Beast or like PewDiePie or whatever, someone might figure out how to get into the head of the curve and they can extract a lot of value, you know, or like the D'Amelios, or, you know, there's these people who will emerge from the network, from the tail into the head, and they can extract value. Other than that, though, the only people who make money are the ones who aggregate up the tail. Right. So I think that that's kind of the answer, is that you either need to create enough, either need to get really lucky so that you can emerge from the tail. You need to create a mass amount of volume into the tail so that you increase your, you know, at bats and your likelihood that you will somehow make it into the head from there, or you're the entity that aggregates the tail itself. But nobody, I don't think anybody really has an advantage in that environment. The other question is, what's the value of established IP in that world? Like, what's Star Wars worth? What's Marvel? What's the MCU worth? What's Harry Potter? You know, those kinds of things, which is a segue to this other piece I wrote that we talked about before we turn on the cameras, which is this idea of IP as platform. And the idea of that if you're a big media company that controls these massive franchises, rather than fight the Fed, right? Rather than try to bat down or dismiss all of this creative energy, right? Why not harness it? Why not figure out a way to enable creators to create content on top of, to build on your IP? And I think that that's, I mean, to me, it's a pretty compelling idea. It's already kind of what happens in music. It's already what happens in the gaming business. We could talk more about it, but I think, you know, so if you think where are the winners, I think it's like any other business where the barriers to entry fall, the aggregate profit pools are going to go down, right? It's hard to see how that's not the case. I think people who have established IP are in a pretty good position as long as they play their cards right.
Yeah, I was tweeting that, you know, and this is kind of like who knows how true this is, but I was like, hey, this is the last generation of movie stars. Everyone beyond here, beyond our era, are going to be virtual movie stars because you don't need to pay them. They don't negotiate salary. They don't need to eat, sleep. They can just work all day. Yep. And they're virtual and they're happy to do that all the time. And what I also said was like Tom Cruise, my great, 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 great grandkids are going to be watching Tom Cruise and Top Gun 85, right?
Right.
And you know, because people, you know, these actors will sell like their AI rights to these people. And so is that something you think it could happen where it's kind of a weird, because it sounds pretty spooky because it just sounds kind of weird. But in reality, like, I just don't see how, I feel like what you said, leaning into the existing IP that you have is like kind of the ultimate play here.
Short answer is, yeah, I think that that's an interesting idea. Like, you could have you could have an actor show up today, spend 3 or 4 days just reading, you know, license their right, you know, their likeness to the director, producer, or whatever, and spend a few days just doing the voiceover, and then go home, and then have the entire rest of the movie shot by, you know, you basically create a metahuman. That's the Unreal technology is metahuman, and Unity has their own you know, digital humans, whatever. But you're going to create a, you know, I'm not saying this is ready for prime time now, but you can see the path to that where, you know, an actor only has to spend a couple of days on set because everything's going to happen digitally after he or she walks off. And then when you look at some of the incredible de-aging technology, I think I made some comment about, you know, let's have 28-year-old Robert Redford and 26-year-old Angelina Jolie star in a movie. Like, you know, stuff like that starts to become feasible, as crazy as it might sound. And then the flip side is, you know, like you said, is, are we going to get to the point where you don't even have recognizable humans in these movies? Right. And right now, so many of the big franchises, people are so doctored anyway, right? Like, what does Thanos look like without the makeup, right? Or you know, look at the Avengers, or you look at the, you know, a lot of these people, their faces aren't even recognizable under all that makeup and prosthetics anyway. So yeah, like that's, like I said before, when you start to like think about all of these things, it's just like really kind of mind boggling how much it might change. How do people respond to that tweet?
Lately, my engagement has been pretty low. So I think that people were, not very impressed. When I tweet about NFT specific things, people respond to that well, because a lot of my followers are related specifically to NFTs. But talking more about the Hollywood angle, or kind of this content angle, is newer for me. So, you know, pretty lackluster, I'd say. But speaking of Hollywood, I want to ask you, like, is this Hollywood's internet moment? Is this like the final, you know, are we finally at a period where Hollywood is being disrupted and these traditional power structures will be over time kind of dismantled?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people in Hollywood would say they've already had their internet moment, that Netflix was the internet moment, because it has been so disruptive already. You know, like if you talk to talent, if you talk to writers, right, I think you had those, I was watching the podcast you did with the Storyco brothers, those guys, and they were talking about a potential for an impending writer strike. You know, the writers all feel like Netflix changed the economics of making TV in a way that has really reduced the upside for a lot of people in the industry, including writers. So I think a lot of people would, if you were in Hollywood right now and asked that question, they would be like, "What are you talking about? That already happened, right?" I think this other shoe to drop is so potentially disruptive that, like I said, it would render the industry almost unrecognizable. Because to your point, I mean, what if the cost structure changes that much and the monetization models change that much? And, you know, who's watching kind of middling cable networks, right? Like there's still pools of value that are created out of, you know, traditional TV that are just ultimately going to completely go away. And this dynamic we're talking about is only going to accelerate that. So I don't know what a lot of these companies are going to look like in a decade.
Wow. Amazing. All right, Doug, time for the closing questions.
All right. Closing questions. Okay. Lightning round or something.
Yeah. Essentially, yes. First one. What are you bearish on?
Well, I am bearish on the profit pools in the entertainment industry. I think that you know, one way or the other, they're headed down.
Does that money shift somewhere else, or does it just kind of, you know, stick with the consumer?
I think it probably shifts into more consumer surplus. I think that consumers are going to end up getting more entertainment for their dollar.
Very cool. What are you bullish on? And it can't be something that we spoke about today specifically.
Well, I think, you know, just to keep it thematically consistent, I think there's some really, you know, when you start to play out what I'm describing, where there's this, you know, flood of quality content, there's probably some interesting, there's probably some interesting plays there. Like, you know, who are the pick and shovel providers? Like, so let's take this, you know, this IP as platform concept. You're Disney, and you create a Disney Filmmaker plugin tool inside Unreal Engine, which has, you know, all these, you know, assets that are preloaded and animations and character, you know, even sound effects and soundtracks or whatever. And you basically give people the ability to create their own content in a no code way, where someone who's really not sophisticated can make something kind of cool, right? And you don't put any guardrails on where they can distribute it. So that stuff's being, you know, posted to some official Disney site, but it's also being posted. It's also going to be uploaded to YouTube, uploaded to TikTok, uploaded who knows where, right? How do you track that? How do you make sure it's monetized, right? Who is that going to be? I mean, we get this whole, we start to segue into this whole question about blockchain-based distribution, right? Where, what if all content is in the clear? Like, where if as a content provider, you're not going to be distributing that on your vertically integrated distribution channel, but you're going to put it, you're going to put it anywhere you possibly can. But that means that someone has to be tracking that so that it can be monetized and properly accounted for and all that sort of stuff. So I think there's going to be some really interesting, I think some of the tools providers, I think some of these, you know, like pick and shovel companies, I don't know who they are yet. I think it's all very early, but I think that's a pretty interesting area that if I knew more about it, I'd say I was bullish on it.
Very cool. That's awesome. All right. What is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
You know, the advice I always got was, you know, just put your head down and do your, you know, put your head down and do your work and don't have your head up all the time looking for the next great opportunity, but really commit to something. And that's probably the best advice I've gotten.
Love it.
Career wise. Right.
What trait most defines who you are?
I give very short answers to questions.
I love it. That's great. That's great.
That's not true at all. Evasive.
Evasive.
No. I don't know. I mean, I really love talking about this stuff. I like love thinking through this stuff and all of the stuff I write, it kind of is like pattern recognition, synthesis, implications, call to action. Like all the pieces I write are kind of in that vein. And it's basically what I've been doing my whole career. So what I love kind of pulling out the signal from the noise, you know? So to me, it's like, I guess I'm a synthesizer. That's what I really enjoy doing.
Very cool. That's awesome. All right. Last question. What motivates you?
Learning. I really enjoy when the learning curve is steep. That to me is the most fun.
That's awesome. All right, Doug, thank you so much. This has been absolutely incredible. I feel like I did like a crash course in everything TV and content and future of, you know, media entertainment. If people wanted to, you know, follow you, where should they go? What should they do?
Probably best bet is to go look at my stuff on Medium. I mean, I have a Twitter, I wouldn't even call it a presence. I think I have like 200 tweets career-wise, you know, over my entire Twitter career. So I have no real presence there, but I am on Twitter and you know, Medium, I think is a good place to check out the long form writing.
Amazing. Thank you, Doug. Appreciate it.
Yeah, Andrew, thank you.
See you.